on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Dan Friedel, and Dan Novak. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The son of a famous street food seller in Bangkok, Thailand, has taken over the stand of his father, who died of COVID-19. Every morning, Adunwit Thansupmani places a picture of his father, Chan Chai, at the front of the food stand, or stall. It is in the Chinatown area of Bangkok under an old movie theater. His father was famous for preparing a kind of rolled rice noodles called guijab. His food was even recognized in recent years by the highly respected Michelin Guide to Worldwide Restaurants. I prepared the broth for my father when he was here, and I still do it when he's gone, the 42-year-old Adunwit told Reuters. I feel he's still around. His father had been operating the food stall for nearly 50 years until he died of COVID-19 in July. He was 73 years old. The shop is what my father loved the most, and I love him most, Adunwit said. I have to keep it going no matter what. He added, we never saw this disease coming into the world, and we never thought it would take so many lives or that it would happen to our family. Chan Chai was one of at least 7 well-known food sellers in Bangkok to die of COVID-19 in recent months, Reuters reports. Now, other family members have taken the responsibility to keep serving the same tasty, high-quality offerings the street chefs created. Even before the pandemic, many street food sellers in Bangkok were feeling financial pressures. They had faced removal orders and bans in recent years as part of city efforts to clean up the streets. As this happened, many nicer traditional restaurants opened up across the city. But Adunwit still has many loyal customers. One of them recently told Reuters that many people seek out the famous stall. When they come over to Chinatown, they know that they have to come and eat rolled rice noodle under the old cinema building. It's made the Chinatown street famous. While Chan Chai's children were immediately ready to take over his stall when he passed, the children of Lotta Satang were not so sure. At first, they debated whether to continue the family's duck stand after their mother died in May. Lotta was a 66-year-old cook with a kind smile. She was known as Grandma C. She ran a stall just 650 meters away from Chan Chai's. After thinking it over, her daughter Sarisa decided to keep the business open and learn everything she could about preparing duck. She thought it would be a good way to honor her mother's memory. I don't want the recipe to disappear. This was her whole life, Sarisa said. I'll be overjoyed if customers say our ducks still taste like my mother's. She added, some tell me not to quit because they can't find food like this anywhere else. I'm Brian Lynn.
Researchers have made a new discovery about a huge and long-lasting storm in the atmosphere of the planet Jupiter. A study published recently in Science says that Jupiter's Great Red Spot, a storm wide enough to cover the Earth, is also extremely deep. The U.S. space agency NASA's spacecraft, Juno, is using special tools to make images of the planet. Scott Bolton of the Southwest Research Institute in Texas was the lead scientist in the study. He said microwave radiation and gravity mapping tools from Juno show the storm fades out slowly and keeps going down. He explained that the storm does not have a clear ending point below the clouds. The storm probably has a depth between 350 and 500 kilometers. It is 16,000 kilometers wide. The planet is known for powerful storms in its atmosphere. Thousands of storms swirl around Jupiter at any time, scientists said. The storms cause the colorful cloud patterns shown by photography and mapping tools. Some of the tools produce images in three dimensions. Bolton said the next project for Juno is to map the storms in the extreme north and south of the planet. They could be even deeper than the Great Red Spot. Bolton said he did not want to guess that the Great Red Spot was the deepest of the planet's storms. He said, however, since the spot is the widest, it might also be the deepest. The Juno spacecraft started orbiting Jupiter in 2016. NASA recently announced the project will be extended to 2025. I'm Dan Friedel.
American school systems usually have gifted and talented programs for students that show a high level of success. Such programs have been under much criticism in recent years. Some parents say they worsen racial segregation and inequities in the country's education system. In early October, the mayor of New York City announced plans to end the gifted and talented programs in the country's largest school system. If it goes forward, that would be a big win for groups supporting an end to similar programs, from Boston, Massachusetts, to Seattle, Washington. From the start, gifted and talented school programs drew worries they would produce an unequal education system in U.S. public schools. Many programs began as efforts to keep white families from leaving racially diverse public schools in urban areas. They were created to compete with high-performing private schools. School leaders and parents increasingly have to deal with difficult questions over equity. They are trying to find ways to teach strong learners while continuing to help other students succeed. It is a question that is driving the debate over whether to grow gifted and talented programs or end them completely. I get the burn it down and tear it down mentality, but what do we replace it with? Asked Marcia Gentry. She is a professor of education and the director of the Gifted Education Research and Resource Institute at Purdue University in Indiana. Gentry co-wrote a study 2 years ago that followed the racial inequities in gifted and talented programs. The study found that U.S. schools identified 3.3 million students as gifted and talented, but an additional 3.6 million who should have also been considered gifted were not included in the programs. The study found these students were disproportionately Black, Latino, and Native American. An Associated Press study of recent federal data found that nationwide, 8.1% of white and 12.7% of Asian American children in public schools are considered gifted, but only 4.5% of Hispanic and 3.5% of Black students are identified as gifted. Gifted and talented programs aim to provide more demanding instruction for students who feel limited with the regular program. Critics of the push to end them say it punishes successful students. They say it also cuts off a chance for students to move up, especially for those from poor families without the means to attend private schools. In Seattle, a former top official of the school system tried to end its gifted and talented program. She blamed it for worsening school segregation. In its own recent study, Seattle Public Schools found only 0.9% of Black children had been identified as gifted, compared with 12.6% of its white students. School leaders have since approved changes to the program. Students will be admitted based on their performance. They are no longer required to take a test to enter the program. The selection committee will also consider input from teachers, family, and community members. Rita Green works for the local NAACP office, a racial justice organization. She said the changes do not go far enough. She wanted the schools to help all of the city's 50,000 students, not just the most successful. "We want the program just abolished," Green said. She added that the program is inherently racist. Since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, other school systems around the U.S. are also rethinking their gifted and talented programs. Boston Schools voted to expand its program and guarantee placements for top students from poorer areas of the city. A top high school in San Francisco, California, removed its entrance exam, as did a top high school in Fairfax, Virginia, where parents recently lost a legal fight to keep the test. Most gifted and talented programs have used test scores to decide which students to admit. Some wealthier families are able to spend thousands of dollars on instruction to increase their child's scores. Nowhere has the debate been as heated as in New York City. Mayor Bill de Blasio said last month that he would begin to end the program, calling it exclusionary. Eric Adams, likely the city's next mayor, said he does not support ending the program. But Gentry, the Purdue researcher, agreed that it was time to fix the equity problems of gifted and talented programs. She urged parents and school officials to do the hard work of finding a compromise. "I know the inequities exist," Gentry said. "I worry that the easy solution is to stop doing it." I'm Dan Novak.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In July of 1861, Union soldiers from the North and Confederate soldiers from the South fought the first major battle in the American Civil War. They clashed at Manassas, or Bull Run, Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The Union soldiers fought fiercely, but two large Confederate forces broke the Union attack. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about some of the other early battles of the Civil War.
Northerners had expected to win the Battle of Bull Run. They believed the Confederacy would fall if the Union won a big military victory early in the war. Now, however, there was great fear that Southern soldiers would seize Washington. The Union needed to build and train an army quickly. President Abraham Lincoln named General George McClellan to do this. McClellan was 34 years old. The young general had two important tasks. He must defend Washington from attack, and he must build an army to strike at enemy forces in Virginia. McClellan wasted no time. He put thousands of troops into position around the city, and he built 48 forts. After this rush of activity, however, little more happened for a long time. McClellan told his wife, "I shall take my own time to make an army that will be sure of success. As soon as I feel my army is well organized and well trained and strong enough, I will force the rebels to a battle." McClellan kept making excuses for why he would not move against the enemy. His excuses became a continuing source of trouble for President Lincoln. The public, the press, and politicians all demanded that McClellan do something. They wanted to win the war, and win it right away.
McClellan commanded the biggest army in the Union, the Army of the Potomac. But it was not the only army. Others were battling Confederate forces in the West. The Confederates had moved up through Tennessee into the border state of Kentucky. They built forts and other defensive positions across the southern part of the state. They also blocked as many railroads and rivers as they could. Their job was to keep Union forces from invading the South through Kentucky. One of the Union generals in the area was Ulysses Grant. Grant had served in the Army for 20 years. He had fought in America's war against Mexico and had won honors for his bravery. When that war ended, he was sent to an army base far from his wife and children. He did not like being without them, and he did not like being an officer in peacetime. Grant began to drink too much alcohol. He began to be a problem. In 1854, he was asked to leave the army. When the Civil War started, Grant organized a group of unpaid soldiers in Illinois. With the help of a member of Congress, he was named a general. All of the other Union generals knew Ulysses Grant. Few had any faith in his abilities. They were sure he would always fail.
Grant, however, had faith in himself and his men. He believed he could force Confederate soldiers to withdraw from both Kentucky and Tennessee. Then he would be free to march directly into the Deep South, Mississippi. Two Confederate forts stood in Grant's way. They were in Tennessee, close to the Kentucky border. United States Navy gunboats captured the first, Fort Henry, on the Tennessee River. That fort was easy to attack and not well defended. The fighting was over by the time Grant and his men got there. The second, Fort Donelson, was nearby on the Cumberland River. It was stronger and defended by 20,000 soldiers. Grant surrounded the fort and let the Navy gunboats shell it. The fighting there lasted several days.
At one point, the Confederates tried to break out of the fort and escape. They opened a hole in the Union line and began to retreat. Suddenly, however, their commanding officer decided it would be wrong to retreat. He ordered them back to the fort. After that, there was no choice. The Confederates would have to surrender. The commanding officer sent a message to General Grant. What were the terms of surrender? Grant's answer was simple. No terms except unconditional and immediate surrender. The Confederates gave up Fort Donelson. Grant took 14,000 prisoners. It was the greatest Union victory since the start of the war. Ulysses Grant was a hero. Newspapers called him Unconditional Surrender Grant.
After the Union victory at Fort Donelson, Confederate forces withdrew from Tennessee. They moved farther south and began to regroup at Corinth, Mississippi. Confederate generals hoped to build one big army to stop Ulysses Grant. They would have to move fast. Grant was marching toward Corinth with 40,000 men. Another 35,000 under the command of Don Buell, were to meet him on the way. Grant arrived in the area first. He waited for Buell 30 kilometers from Corinth, near a small country meeting hall called Shiloh Church. Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston was waiting, too. He had more than 40,000 men, about the same as Grant, and he was expecting another 20,000. But when he learned that Grant was nearby, he decided not to wait. He would attack immediately.
Johnston did not know it, but his attack came as a surprise to the Union Army. Union officers had refused to believe reports that Johnston was on the move. They said his army was not strong enough to attack. Union troops did not prepare defensive positions. They had no protection when the battle began. The fighting at Shiloh was the bitterest of the war. It was not one battle, but many. Groups of men fought each other all across the wide battlefield. From a distance, they shot at each other. Close up, they cut each other with knives. The earth became red with blood. The dead and wounded soon lay everywhere. At first, the Confederates pushed Grant's army back. They had only to break through one more line, and victory would be theirs. But in the thick of the struggle, General Johnston was shot in the leg. The bullet cut through an artery. Johnston bled to death before help arrived. Any hope for a southern victory at Shiloh died with him. By the time the fighting began again the next day, General Buell had arrived to help Grant. The Confederate Army retreated. The Union Army let it go.
Shiloh, the word itself, came to mean death and destruction. The Battle of Shiloh had brought home to the American people, both of the North and South, the horror of war. It was the first time so many men, 100,000, had fought against each other in the Western world. It was the American people's first real taste of the bloodiness of modern warfare. As one soldier who fought there said, it was too shocking, too horrible. I hope to God that I may never see such things again. The North won the Battle of Shiloh, but it paid a very high price for victory. More than 13,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing. On the Confederate side, more than 10,000 soldiers were killed or wounded. The North celebrated the news of its victory, but joy quickly turned to anger when the public learned of the heavy losses. People blamed General Grant. They demanded that President Lincoln dismiss him. Lincoln thought of the two men who were now his top military commanders, McClellan and Grant. They were so different. McClellan organized an army and then did nothing. Grant organized an army and moved. Lincoln said of Grant, "I cannot do without this man. He fights."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.